Welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health. This is where we highlight the groundbreaking work being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. It's part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. I'm Joel Katz, and joining me this week, Dr. Simone Mays, breast surgical oncologist at JFK University Medical Center. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Joel. Nice to be here, too.
Yes, nice to have you. Well, let's talk about how you got into being a breast surgeon and how long you've been doing it and so forth.
Sure. So I'll start with medical school. So I went to medical school at Drexel University in Philadelphia, graduated, and then went on to do a general surgery residency training program at Brookdale Hospital, which is in Brooklyn, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And that program lasted about 6 years. There's a 1 year of dedicated research. And the reason why I'm bringing that up is because that's what really kind of brought forth my interest in breast surgical oncology. So for a year, I spent at Cornell doing research in breast surgical oncology, and it really, you know, opened up my eyes to the intricacies and nuances and just the vast nature of how you hone, you know, creating a care plan for breast cancer patients. And so that ultimately piqued my interest in going into breast surgical oncology. So after I finished my general surgery residency, I went on to do a fellowship in breast surgical oncology at Bryn Mawr Hospital, which is in Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
and finished that in 2020, and have been working as a breast surgical oncologist since then.
So it was about 10 years before you actually decided what you really wanted to do, which is what you're doing now. 10 years of education.
Yes. Well, we're not counting the undergrad, and I did a few years of graduate school training. But yes, there is an extensive education process as well as technical training. And really one of the things that I love about medicine is that you're constantly learning. So, for example, with breast surgical oncology, when I trained, which is, you know, not that long ago, since then there have been a lot of changes in how we approach breast cancer treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though you're in practice, you still have to maintain that, you know, thirst for knowledge and understanding and staying up to date with the current practices, because there's always ongoing research, new studies coming out that are altering how we approach, you know, breast cancer management, improving our ability to, you know, eradicate the disease. And so that's one of the things that I love about medicine is that, you know, you're a lifelong learner. So the training, yes, is long and extensive, but I think you have to really have a thirst for knowledge. And I like the challenge of, you know, having to, you know, stay on top of things and always learning and growing. I think that makes us, you know, better providers when we are forced to have to do that in order to provide the most up-to-date care for our patients.
Sure, yeah. And you're in one of the top facilities around. What attracted you to JFK?
Well, actually, I grew up in Plainfield, so I'm very familiar with JFK. And so when the opportunity presented itself to come there, you know, it was just kind of a no-brainer for me. You know, being close to home, being in a community that is very diverse, and also being a part of something as far as, you know, enhancing and improving the cancer services at JFK Hospital. You know, that opportunity is what really attracted me, you know.
Yeah. So you're playing for the home team.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I've been in Brooklyn for quite some time. You know, as I mentioned, I did my training there, and I've been practicing there since fellowship. So that's kind of like become my surgical home. But, you know, at JFK, Edison, Central Jersey area, that's home. You know, this is where I was, you know, raised and where, you know, I live and where, you know, I have lots of friends and family in the area. So,
yeah,
I'm leaving home, but also coming home.
Yeah, perfect scenario. You go, you know, you're from Central Jersey, you go away to New York, you go away to Philly, which is my hometown, by the way, and now you're back home. It's a great story.
Yes, kind of doing a full circle.
So you haven't started yet at JFK. When have you started yet?
No, I'll be starting next month. But a day-to-day for me would be, you know, seeing patients in the office. And I don't only take care of breast cancer patients. I also take care of patients who have benign breast issues, mm-hmm. also patients who are at high risk for breast cancer. That's actually one of the things that I really want to facilitate, you know, creating a high-risk screening program mm-hmm. at JFK, because I think it's very important for women to understand what their risks are and what things they can do to help mitigate some of those risks, and how their screening is a little bit different compared to women who we consider to be average risk. So they'd be, you know, seeing patients in the office, you know, obviously doing surgeries, and being part of the Hackensack Meridian Health System and, you know, their connection with the medical school, also, you know, being active and training, you know, the next generation of clinicians. So, you know, it's just a really exciting time for me, because it's kind of a combination, a culmination of all the things that are important to me. You know, a community hospital, it's in the community, but there's academics with the medical school and other trainees that are there. And so, you know, it's just it's the perfect marriage of, you know, those things, because I'm a big community person. I love doing things in the community and doing outreach and educating the community about, you know, how they can go about maintaining a healthy life. And, you know, and as it relates to breast cancer, you know, what's the appropriate screening, how often you should be doing it, what are the things to look out for, you know, all of those different things are important to make sure our community is, you know, well-informed, so that they can make the best decisions for their overall health and well-being.
Well, let's jump into that. Let's talk about one of the first thing you said, how often to get a screening. How important the screenings are, because that's number one, right?
Yes. So screening should start at the age of 40, and it should be on an annual basis. Now, there's a little bit of, I want to say discrepancy, but there's a little bit of a difference in what the U.S. Task Force recommends versus what the Breast Surgical Oncology Society, as well as the American Society of Radiology, recommends. You know, the U.S. Task Force says you can start at 40 and you can do it every year or every 2 years. I strongly recommend every year, and the reason for that is because there are types of breast cancer that are aggressive, and you can have a normal mammogram, and 6, 7, 8, 9 months later, you can feel a lump in the breast, and it's cancerous. So I strongly encourage women to get their mammograms on an annual basis, because things can change from year to year. And so we just recommend it because of that reason. But definitely once you turn 40, you should be having a mammogram at a minimum every 2 years, but preferably on an annual basis.
Why not sooner? Why not 30? And why not every 6 months? I mean, how do you draw the line? You know, how is that decided? And you said there's a discrepancy between a couple of different, you know, different thoughts on the subject.
That's a great and excellent question. I get that question all the time, because we are seeing women diagnosed with breast cancer earlier in their lives. You know, it's not unheard of to see a woman in their 30s who are diagnosed with breast cancer. But when we're constructing, you know, screening protocols, we're looking at the entire population. And so you have to look at what is the incidence of breast cancer in those individual populations. And so women under the age of 40, you know, the incidence is not zero, but it doesn't reach a level where it would make sense to screen every single woman, you know, in their 30s. With a mammogram. And as it relates to the second part of your question, you know, why not every 6 months? Again, most breast cancers are not fast rapidly growing cancers, but I did mention that there is a subset of cancers that are more aggressive, which is why we tend not to want to push it off for every 2 years. But the amount of those type of breast cancers is not enough to say, oh, we should be having mammograms every 6 months, if that makes sense. So we have to kind of look at the whole entire general population, the frequency in which we see cancer in those particular groups. And so that's why, you know, the recommendations are as they are.
Talking with Dr. Simone Mays, breast surgical oncologist at JFK University Medical Center. So in a perfect world, how often and how early would you like to see mammograms performed? And I know you said 40, but I mean, in a perfect world where it doesn't, I mean, we're talking about a 1 day's visit to the doctor, right?
Right. Well, the thing is, with mammograms, particularly in younger women, women who are, you know, under the age of 40, the density of their breast tissue can sometimes complicate the ability to accurately detect things in the breast.
Okay.
And so the reason why we wouldn't want to just go ahead and screen all of those women, you know, on an annual basis is because it opens up a lot of anxiety. I think that's one of the things that often gets missed. You know, I always get, you know, these conversations with patients who are just very anxious. They have a mammogram. You know, they're called back until they need to have more imaging. And it just triggers this cascade of anxiety because, you know, everyone is concerned, oh, my goodness, do they see something that cancerous? And so although it seems like, yeah, it's just a, you know, once a year, 20 minutes, quick in and out for a mammogram, it does open up patients to maybe some additional interventions that have to be done in order to ensure that there isn't something going on in the breast. And so it's not as straightforward as it may seem because of the complexity of the breast tissue. And from an imaging standpoint, you know, it can sometimes be a little bit challenging to decipher exactly what's going on. And then these patients may need to have repeat imaging like every 6 months just to make sure that things are stable. And oftentimes it ends up being nothing. And so the risk of having that kind of situation is much higher in younger women. Because of the density of their breast tissue. And also, you know, we're looking at weighing the risk and the benefits of that. You know, risk, certainly there's not a risk of death or, you know, bodily harm from doing mammograms in that age group. But the it's a real risk as it relates to, you know, the anxiety behind, you know, having things seen, not really being able to say for sure that it's not anything, you know, suspicious, versus, you know, the benefit of maybe detecting one and, you know, 1,000 or 10,000, you know, don't quote me on the exact numbers, as far as, you know, a breast cancer. And so that's why we don't recommend doing mammograms routinely in someone under the age of 40. Certainly, if a patient is experiencing something in their breast as far as a lump or nipple discharge or changes to the skin, you know, if they're having symptoms, then certainly we will do the appropriate workup as it relates to mammogram and ultrasound to, you know, assess those new findings. But just as a routine thing, you know, the benefit of maybe detecting one or two, you know, breast cancers, you know, here and there, is certainly not, it doesn't rise to the level to make it a blanket screening process for all women in that age group.
Thank you for sharing that. There are great points, and there are things that I didn't realize, like the anxiety. Because, you know, my thought was, and you probably sensed this when I asked the question, was why not get it every year just to be careful? You know, start when you're 20. But, yeah, there are other factors involved. It just doesn't make sense. And I guess an analogy I could use, like we all drive and we're in car accidents, but and if we all wore helmets when we drove our cars, that might help, but maybe that's a little overkill.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great analogy.
We're talking with Dr. Simone Mays, breast surgical oncologist, JFK University Medical Center. Let's talk about when a patient comes into you, or let's say they go for an exam and something is found, and you can give the example of what that something is, and please tell us where it goes from there and the journey that woman might go through.
Sure. Thank you for that question. So let's just start with a standard lump. You know, let's say it's a 40-year-old woman. She was taking a shower and noticed a lump in her breast that wasn't there before. So she comes into the office. You know, I do the full history. You know, family history is important. I mentioned earlier about a woman's risk for developing breast cancer. So there are several different factors that we look at to determine what a woman's risk for breast cancer is. And a few of those are, you know, how old they were when they first had their first menstrual period. If they have children, how old they were when they had their first child. I mentioned the breast density. Family history is, you know, an important information to know about a woman if she has a mother who had breast cancer or a sister or aunt. You know, those are important things to get when we're taking a history. And then on the examination, you know, we're looking at the breast, we're looking at the symmetry of the breast, we're looking at the skin. Are there any changes, any redness, any firmness of the skin? And then the mass itself, we're looking at several different factors as it relates to, is this something suspicious for cancer or is this something that is non-cancerous? Because there are lumps in the breast, and most often in women under the age of 40, lumps in the breast are not cancerous. So we look at certain features. One, the firmness. Is it hard like a rock, or is it, you know, soft and bouncy? Is it well circumscribed, meaning I can feel a distinct difference between the lump and the surrounding tissue, or is it kind of indistinct? Does it move around with the breast tissue, or is it like firm and fixed and hard and just stagnant in the breast tissue? So those are all different things that we look at to kind of give us some clues as to whether this is something suspicious or not. And anytime you see a lump in the breast for a woman above the age of 30, they're going to need a mammogram. So mammogram would be the next step after we go through the whole history and physical. And also in addition to that, any kind of palpable mass in the breast, we also do an ultrasound in addition to the mammogram. So that would be the initial kind of step beyond when they come into the office for their initial evaluation. And then depending on what the findings are on the mammogram and ultrasound, if it's something that's suspicious, then the next step would be to do a biopsy. And for most masses in the breast that you can feel, that would be done with an ultrasound and a needle. And then beyond that, it would determine, you know, what it is, and then that would guide, you know, the decision-making process as to what would be the appropriate management and intervention.
I see. And so what would be an example of something that is found and then treated?
So let's start with something that is non-cancerous.
Okay.
So I mentioned that oftentimes there are lumps in the breast that are not cancerous. So if we're talking about a 40-year-old woman who has a non-cancerous mass, and most often it's something called a fibroadenoma. It's a very common mass in the breast, and it's essentially the components of the breast tissue that come together and form a lump. As I mentioned, they're benign, they're not cancerous, and they don't turn into cancer. So depending on the size of the mass, we could just leave it alone and monitor it with repeat imaging. Or if the patient is uncomfortable, that, you know, there's something that they can clearly feel, we often offer the option of removing it surgically. Now, if we're talking about a mass that turns out to be cancer, then there's a whole host of things that are going to happen beyond that point. So one of the things that I always emphasize to patients about breast cancer is that there are many different types of breast cancer. And because it's so common, you'll be hard-pressed to find someone that doesn't know someone who's had breast cancer.
Sure, yeah.
And so oftentimes what happens is if when a woman is diagnosed with breast cancer, they start thinking about those other people that they know who have had breast cancer mm-hmm. and the things that they had to go through in order to treat their breast cancer. And so I always caution patients about doing that because there are so many different factors that we take into account in order to tailor the most appropriate treatment plan for a patient. So some of those things include the size of the mass. There's a thing called tumor markers. So our breast tissue is designed by nature to respond to two hormones, estrogen and progesterone. So that's what we start producing when we go through puberty and mm-hmm. start developing breasts. So the breast naturally has the ability to respond to estrogen and progesterone. And so when we're dealing with breast cancer, we want to determine whether or not the cancer cells also respond to the estrogen and progesterone that we naturally make as women. And so the way we do that is by checking for what we call tumor markers on the cancer cells. So depending on the findings of that, we'll determine which treatments the cancer is more likely to respond to. In addition to that, there's a third marker that we look at, which is called HER2, H-E-R-2. I won't get into the science behind it, but it's okay. not related to hormones. But it is another marker that we look at on cancer cells, breast cancer cells, to, again, determine which treatments are best that the cancer is more responsive to based on those findings. So beyond that, we look at, you know, how advanced the cancer is. Is there any evidence of cancer in the lymph nodes? So lymph nodes are part of our immune system. And the way in which breast cancer can travel from the breast to other parts of our body is through our lymphatic channels and through our lymph nodes. So the breast tissue anatomically will drain into the lymph nodes in our armpit area. So that's part of our standard evaluation of the breast is we not only look at the breast, but we also look at the lymph nodes in the armpit area.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we have a patient that is diagnosed with breast cancer, we check those from an imaging standpoint, also from a physical exam standpoint. So depending on whether there's any evidence of suspicious findings in the lymph nodes, that also guides our decision-making process. So it's hard to give a nice, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 example for breast cancer because there are so many different factors that come into play. One of the other things that we have to look at is genetics. I didn't mention it as of yet, but yes, genetics is something that we often look at when we're talking about women being diagnosed with breast cancer. And the recommendations for undergoing genetic testing has definitely expanded over the years. And so what I mean by genetic testing is there are genes in our bodies that tell us, you know, what our hair color is, what our eye color is, mm-hmm. all the different features that we have as human beings. And over the years, we have identified genes that if there are alterations, which we use the term mutation. Sometimes I use alterations because when you say mutations, oftentimes people's minds go to like, you know, aliens or something like that.
Right.
So I always use the term alterations, changes in a gene that will make someone at risk of developing not only breast cancer, but other types of cancer. And so we check that in certain individuals who are diagnosed with breast cancer to determine, do they have any genetic predisposition to mm-hmm. developing breast cancer? Because if they do, then our recommendations oftentimes will change based on those particular findings. So as I mentioned, it's very nuanced. It's very individualized. It also depends on the patient's wishes. When I meet patients and we sit down and we talk, I always approach it as a collective decision-making process. Mm-hmm. It's not you coming to me and me telling you what you have to do. My job is to assess you, get all the information we need to make a well-informed decision, and go through, you know, those decision options with each patient, with the understanding that, you know, this is your life, this is your body, and so I want you to be empowered to make the most appropriate decision for you. Mm-hmm. And so that also comes into play when we're making decisions about treatment plans.
Sure, I understand.
So it's hard to just kind of give a one scenario, but just to kind of give a sense of how that process works, what we look at, and how we approach it is important.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. And it has flown by. I find it fascinating. Thank you for being, the clarity in your explanations is just fantastic. And I appreciate you being here. I welcome you back to Central Jersey to be here JFK University Medical Center. Dr. Simone Mays, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
That's a wrap. For more info, you can go to jfkmc.org. And for a podcast of this show, you can go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. JFK Spotlight on Health, brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz, and we'll talk to you next week.